This is Richard Verone, and I'm conducting an oral history interview with Mr. Donald Davis. Today is March 6, 2003. It's a little after 11 a.m. Central Standard Time. I'm in Lubbock, Texas, at Texas Tech University at the Southwest Collections Special Collections Library Interview Room. Mr. Davis, you're in Oxnard, California, is that correct?
That's correct.
Okay, great. Sir, if we could start with some biographical information on yourself, could you tell us when and where you were born and a little bit about your childhood?
Yeah, I was born in Tulia, Texas.
Okay. Not too far from here.
I grew up there. I graduated from high school there.
Mm-hmm. What year did you graduate high school, sir?
1942.
Okay. And how would you describe your childhood in Tulia? What was it like?
Well, it was, it was a quiet little country town and a very comfortable place to grow up there, very safe. And I was, everybody knew everybody. And
right.
It was a nice, friendly place and a nice environment to grow up in.
Okay. How many brothers and sisters did you have?
I have two brothers and one sister.
Okay. And were they older or younger than you?
The sister's older and the brothers are younger.
Okay. Okay. What did your parents do for a living?
My father was a rancher.
Okay.
A ranch manager. And my mother was, at one time, was the county clerk at Swisher County.
Mm-hmm.
And later she reverted to her housewife role.
Okay, okay. What kind of ranch did your father work on or manage?
It's a cattle ranch.
Okay, all right. And what kind of memories do you have of the Great Depression? You were born in 25, so you were a young boy at that time, but do you have memories of that time?
Yeah, I have some memories of it, but the situation was such that being in a rural area like that, there was no shortage of food.
Right.
Both of my grandparents lived there, and they had big vegetable gardens and maybe butchered a pig or something.
Yes, sir.
So there was never any deprivation in that respect.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, nobody had much money, but we didn't know we were poor.
Right. Okay. So it was a normal childhood to you. Would you describe it as such?
Yeah, I'd say so.
Okay, okay. Did any of your relatives serve in World War I or World War II?
Yeah, my father served in World War I.
Really? What did he do in the war?
He was in the Transportation Corps in the Third Army in France.
Okay. So did he? Tell you, talk to you about his experiences in Europe?
To some degree.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What kind of emphasis did he place upon you or any of your brothers going into the military?
He was very supportive. He had after the World War I, he stayed in the Army of Occupation until 1920.
Okay.
And when he came back to the States, he joined the Texas National Guard.
Okay.
For a year or two, so he was a strong military supporter and always encouraged me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. What do you remember about your early schooling there in Tulia? What was that like?
Well, it was just, I had a small class. There were less than 30 people in my class.
Mm-hmm.
And of course, the school was so small that you knew everybody in the school.
Yes, sir.
And their family.
Mm-hmm.
So, it was a very friendly environment, and my only problem was that my sister was a straight-A student, and, of course, she preceded me through the school,
right.
And everybody expected me to perform to her standard.
Right. Did that happen? Did that happen?
I didn't perform to her standard, no.
Okay.
But right. I did all right.
Yeah. What were your favorite subjects in school?
I'd say math and science, physics and chemistry and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Did that come easy to you? Did you have a natural inclination to the sciences, or was it something you were just really interested in?
It was just something I was interested in.
Uh-huh. Okay.
I had decided I wanted to get into engineering, and I knew I had to have a background in those courses to qualify.
Right. Do you remember anything about Franklin Roosevelt as president?
Oh, yeah.
Can you talk to me a little bit about that? What did you think of him as president?
Well, I recall when he declared war on Japan and Germany.
Yes, sir. I bet you do.
And in fact, I was well aware of his being there before, long before that, because he was elected, you know, when I was about just starting school.
Yes, sir.
So I was well aware of that he was the president, and mm-hmm. and as the war progressed, I was became acutely aware of mm-hmm. of his part as the commander in chief.
Right.
And of course, when I went in the Army in 1943, and mm-hmm. of course he was still the president.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Now, when you were in high school in Tulia, did you plan to try to go to college, or were you looking at a military career? Or, I mean, this is there in the 40s, so the war was on. Was everybody kind of looking through the military?
Well, I was. The first thing I did I was 17 when I graduated from high school. Mm-hmm. And so I went down and enrolled in Texas A&M mm-hmm. and for one semester.
Okay.
And I went home at the end of that semester, and the draft board, who I knew well, mm-hmm. advised me not to go back.
Okay.
Because I was going to be drafted.
Okay.
So I had one semester of college at Texas A&M before I went in the Army.
Okay. Were you, in fact, drafted, or did you go ahead and enlist yourself?
I volunteered to get in the Army's flying training program.
Okay. Now, what made you want to get into the flying training?
Well, I don't know. I just thought that flying was a neat thing to do. I'd had a friend that had an airplane, and I'd had a few rides. And mm-hmm. I decided that if I was going to go to the war, I'd just as soon go in an airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Or I prefer to go in an airplane.
Right. What did your parents think about you going into the military and going off to war?
Well, my mother didn't accept it too well,
mm-hmm.
of course. But my father, you know, understood my feelings, and which he reflected his when he was my age. And
mm-hmm.
So he was very supportive.
Mm-hmm. How would you describe the mood of the United States, the population, during World War II?
Well, I just see it. Everybody was highly energized mm-hmm. to win that war
mm-hmm.
and do whatever they could to help,
mm-hmm.
whether it was to join the military or go to work for a defense plant or
mm-hmm.
or stay home and run the farm or whatever it took, the best they could do.
Mm-hmm.
But I think everybody was pretty well oriented toward supporting the war effort and doing what they could to help.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever see the United States population in the 20th century after World War II ever behave like that again, ever be unified like that again?
No, I don't believe I did.
Really? Because it obviously contrasts with what happened during the Vietnam years with so much dissension. It obviously contrasted with what happened during the Vietnam years in the 60s and 70s.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And, you got to see, you know, both ends of the spectrum.
I'm sorry, say again.
I'm saying you got to see both ends of the spectrum.
Yes, I did.
Mm-hmm. So tell me about your initial training in the Army Air Corps.
Well, I just went through the standard flight training program. That,
mm-hmm.
First, we had to go to basic training, just like we had enlisted.
Mm-hmm.
And that lasted about a month. And
where was that, sir?
Biloxi, Mississippi.
Okay. Was that difficult for you?
No, because I just finished the semester in the ROTC.
Oh, okay. So at A&M, you enrolled in the ROTC.
Right. In fact, it gave me a leg up because I already knew how to do close-order drills.
Right, right. Okay.
So that was one of my payoffs for that semester I spent at Texas A&M.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So you were able to adapt to the military lifestyle fairly easily?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What kind of memories do you have of basic training?
Well, I was in an unusual group. I just came from civilian life, and a number of us arrived down there on a train. And when my class started, they had just started to allow enlisted people to go through the training in grade.
Mm-hmm.
Prior to that, they'd had to take a bus to private to get in the flying program.
Mm-hmm.
So we had master sergeants on down in my squadron, in my
really?
Basic squadron.
Wow.
and that was kind of interesting because I recall we had a corporal who was in charge of our flight, and he had maybe six master sergeants and a few techs and right on down, and about half of us were really, you know, basic trainees. So it made kind of an interesting situation because those old sergeants didn't take too kindly to the corporal telling them what to do.
I bet so. How did you guys adapt to that? Was that difficult?
Yeah, well, it didn't last very long because we had all those enlisted people among us. They sent us off to a college training detachment.
Okay.
For 3 months of college.
Okay. Where was that?
It was Michigan College of Mining and Technology.
Up in Michigan.
Houghton, Michigan.
Okay. And what did you do there exactly?
They just basically gave us one semester of a basic engineering course, math and physics, and all the related courses that you would normally expect in the first year of college.
Why did they do that? Why did they send you all up there?
They didn't have enough room in the training program.
Okay.
That was kind of a holding maneuver, and that, plus it gave us all a leg up on the, you know, getting smart.
Yes, sir. So when you finished that semester up in Michigan, did you return down to Biloxi?
No. We shipped out to Santa Ana, California.
Okay.
To the Army basic training, basic flying school.
Okay. Was that the first time that you were able to actually train in airplanes?
At Santa Ana, there was no flying. It was all academic.
Oh, okay. So it was all classroom.
Yeah, and what they call classification, they gave us a series of psychomotor tests to determine whether we're going to be pilots or navigators or bombardiers.
And how did you perform on those tests?
I did very well.
Okay. And what was your classification?
Pilot.
Now, is that what you wanted to be, or did
Yeah.
I didn't know if you wanted to be a support person, but...
No, I wanted to be a pilot.
Okay. What did your parents think about you going, you know, so far away from home and then going into being a pilot, which is, at that time, a really dangerous enterprise?
Well, I think by that time, I think my mother had pretty well accepted my fate. And, of course, my father was still quite enthusiastic about me getting into that program and the possibility of getting a commission. He liked that.
Right. Was your training kind of geared to finishing it as quickly as possible and then getting overseas, or would you say it was kind of average and it really, you were trained thoroughly before you would go anywhere?
It was a standardized program, and you spent about 3 months in primary training, 3 months in basic, and 3 months in advanced.
Okay.
And you start off, of course, with primary training aircraft and work your way up to advanced trainers.
So tell me what it was like when you first got behind the controls and you flew.
Well, it was pretty exciting for me. And I had a good experience. The uniform for flying consisted of a cloth helmet with goggles.
Right.
And when we started flying, everybody had to wear the goggles around their neck.
Okay.
And then as soon as you soloed, then you could wear the goggles up on your head.
Okay.
So this was a badge of accomplishment.
Yes, sir.
Now, I was the first one in my class to solo. And then the next week, the weather got bad, and nobody else soloed, so I was the only guy in the squadron that had goggles up on
I bet you were proud of that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, how was flying to you? Was it difficult, or did it come easy to you?
I had, I guess, fairly natural talent for it. It was always fairly easy for me, and I got good ratings.
Okay. Did you receive really good instruction there?
Yeah, the primary instructors were civilians, and, of course, they were old-timers, and they were really good. As we advanced through the programs, like when we got into advanced training, I had an instructor who just graduated the class ahead of me.
Okay. So, wow.
quality of instruction wasn't quite as good, but they had a system of check flights and that you had to take as you progressed through the program.
So. Yes, sir. Yes, sir. What kind of aircraft were you flying as you progressed through the program?
The primary trainer was a PT-22.
Okay.
Ryan. The basic trainer was a BT-13, a Vultee called a, fondly known as the Vultee Vibrator. And advanced trainer was an AT-17, which was a Cessna Bobcat.
Okay. Which of those three planes did you like the best?
Oh, I guess the primary trainer.
Really? Why is that?
Well, you could do all of the acrobatics in it. It was, you know, a little more of a challenge to fly. Than the larger airplanes are more stable, but there are fewer things you can do.
Right. Now, did they allow you to do acrobatics, or did you
guys... Oh, yeah, I was part of the course.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay. What other tactics did they teach you?
Say again?
What other tactics did they teach you there as you went through your training?
Primarily, it was just flying. Of course, there was ground school, and they teach you weather and navigation and mechanics and aerodynamics.
When you finished your advanced training, where did you go?
I went to Carlsbad, New Mexico, to a bombardier school.
Okay.
And I flew training missions for the bombardier cadets. And I did that until the war ended a year or so later.
Now, did you expect to get into the war, or did you
the system was that if you stayed in the training command like I did, that you could expect to stay there a year and then go to a combat assignment. Well, of course, the war was over about the time I came due for a combat assignment.
Were you disappointed?
Well, I wouldn't say disappointed, but I got married and I had some other things to do. And
right.
So I planned to go right back to college, which I did at the end of World War II.
Okay, so when you finished your bombardier training, you went back to college?
Yeah.
Okay. What airplanes were you flying in bombardier training?
AT-11s.
AT-11s, okay.
Yeah.
All right. Where did you go back to college?
I went to the University of Colorado.
Okay. And did you end up graduating there?
Yes, I did.
Okay. And what years were you at the University of Colorado?
46 through 49.
Okay. And what did you study there?
Mechanical engineering.
It seems like you had a natural talent for engineering.
Yeah, well, early sometime in my academic career, some instructor that I respected told me I ought to be an engineer.
Oh, really?
So I guess that's one reason that I kind of got started in that direction.
Were you part of any of the military programs at University of Colorado while you were there?
No. I was a GI Bill student.
Okay.
$90 a month.
That's what it cost you, or that's what you would receive from
that's
the government?
That's what I received.
Really? How much did a role did the GI Bill play in you going to college?
In my case, it just made it a lot easier because my family could hardly have afforded to send me. But, you know, especially since I'd gotten married. So the GI Bill was really a godsend for me because it allowed me to go to school and my wife worked and came out just fine.
Okay. Let me ask you about April 1945. How did you feel, or do you remember how you felt when Franklin Roosevelt died?
I just remember it was a sad day, it was just kind of a gloomy situation. There was not much frivolity around the officers' club. That's about all I remember.
What was your impression of Harry Truman?
My original impression was that he was a hick haberdasher from Missouri.
Okay.
But progressed, I grew to have a lot of respect for him. In fact, the first time I voted, I voted for him.
Okay. When you graduated from Colorado in 1949, this is right before the Korean War is going to start. Did you go back into the military, or did you remain a civilian?
I joined the Colorado National Guard, Air National Guard. Yeah.
Where were you stationed?
At Denver, Buckley Air Base.
Okay.
Denver.
Okay. And what did you do there?
I was a communications maintenance officer.
Okay. And how long before, when you were there, how long was it until the Korean War started?
It had actually started about the time I joined the Air Guard.
Okay.
And they sent me to a communications school for a year.
Mm-hmm. Where was that?
At Scott Air Force Base in Illinois.
Okay. And so what did you learn there at Scott?
All facets of communications, mm-hmm. Electronics and maintenance and code and radios and mm-hmm. how to climb in poles and string and wire and a whole gamut of communications business.
Mm-hmm. Had you been moving away from being a pilot on purpose, or was this just kind of what the Army Air Corps wanted to do with you?
An opportunity that I had to go to that school.
Mm-hmm. Did it benefit your career later, do you think?
Yes, it did. Shortly after I got out of the school, they federalized my guard unit
mm-hmm.
and sent my squadron to Germany.
Okay. Was this in 1951?
Yeah.
Okay. So you went to Germany. Where were you stationed in Germany?
Initially in Landsberg,
mm-hmm.
with the headquarters 12th Air Force.
What were your duties there?
I was a communications maintenance officer.
Okay. And can you describe kind of what you would do there on base?
We maintained the base communication system,
mm-hmm.
but our primary function was to support the headquarters 12th Air Force on field maneuvers.
Okay.
We had a lot of mobile radio equipment and teletype equipment, and we had three fighter wings, and we maintained communications with the headquarters and those three fighter wings.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Was there ever a threat of you being called up and sent to Korea, or did you know that you would probably stay in Europe?
I knew I was going to be in Europe for 3 years.
Okay, so it was a three-year tour.
Yeah.
Okay. And how was Germany for you? Did your wife, was she able to come over?
Yes, she was. She did, and our second child was born there.
Mm-hmm.
And we had, of course, the first year we lived in requisitioned housing, which was a little cottage out in Bavaria.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a maid,
mm-hmm.
a full-time maid, and a gardener that kept the yard up.
Mm-hmm.
So it was pretty plush living.
Sounds like it. What rank were you when you were in Germany?
I was a first lieutenant.
Okay. Tell me what you think about the Korean War. What are your memories of that conflict?
A little bit negative because I didn't think that we were prepared for what happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you recall things like the Chosin Reservoir where people were freezing to death up there in the
yes,
north,
sir.
And,
mm-hmm.
and they were getting trapped, and then we got trapped by the Chinese communists up there.
Mm-hmm.
So it just seemed to me that it wasn't too well planned or it wasn't too well commanded.
Mm-hmm. Who did you blame for that? Was that, do you think, the White House's fault, or was that the military commander's fault, or just kind of everybody was caught off guard?
Well, it's the commander-in-chief's fault. And,
mm-hmm.
the civilian element that, got us into the war.
Mm-hmm. What did you
think? The military responds.
I'm sorry?
I said the military just responds.
Yes, sir.
You may have your private opinions, but when you're sent up there to do the job, you do it.
Mm-hmm. Did you agree with President Truman and the United States saying that it was a police action, a kind of a United Nations police action versus a war?
I looked at it more like a war because I was aware of people I knew that were over there getting shot at and shot down.
Yes, sir.
I didn't see it so much as a police action.
Mm-hmm. Did you continue your flying while you were in Germany?
Yes, I did.
Okay, I guess you had to stay qualified. And,
yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I had to. I was primarily what they call proficiency flying.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I had to fly at least 4 hours a month just to get paid.
Right. What were you flying over in Germany?
C-47.
Okay, so you had gone to a larger transport type plane.
Yeah.
How did you like the transports versus the smaller aircraft?
I liked it all right, because I didn't have any combat experience at that time, and the C-47 was kind of a natural step up from the AT-11, which I had a lot of time in.
Mm-hmm.
So it was an easy transition for me to go to the C-47, and I enjoyed it. We had a lot of interesting flying up there. Weather in the wintertime in Germany, the weather was always bad, and so we got a lot of weather time and a lot of good flying experience.
Mm-hmm. One other question about the Korean War. What did you think of President Truman relieving General MacArthur?
I thought it was a great idea.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did you feel that way?
Because I thought MacArthur was incompetent.
Okay. Why so? Just because he had performed poorly on the peninsula, or what?
Well, he wanted us to go into China.
Yes, sir.
And I knew that was not a good idea.
Mm-hmm. And so you think Truman did the right thing and kind of got rid of
it? Yes,
got rid
indeed. Of him. I certainly do.
Okay, okay. What was your impression of Dwight Eisenhower, the next president?
He's one of my heroes.
Really?
Yes.
Why do you feel that way?
Well, I thought he was a good commander, and he had come up through the school of hard knocks, and I thought he did a very good job in Europe and all through the World War II in that phase of his career.
Yes, sir. And you think he was a pretty effective president?
Yeah, I do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not as spectacular as some might have liked, but when you look back on his term as president, I think you'd have to conclude that he did a very good job.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So 1954, is that when you left Germany?
Yeah.
Okay. And where did you go from Germany?
Well, I went to the Air Force Institute of Technology for a couple of years and got a graduate degree.
Mm-hmm. What was your degree in?
It's in armament systems engineering.
Okay. Can you explain why you got into that?
Why I did that?
Yes, sir.
Well, it was an opportunity to get a graduate degree, and that was the only thing that I was elected for.
Okay.
I didn't have any choice of what course to take.
Okay. Why were you elected to that course particularly?
I suppose because I had an engineering background. Plus my electronics experience. And armament systems engineering is a kind of a combination of electrical engineering and aeronautical engineering, mechanical engineering. So it all kind of fit together.
How long was that training?
2 years.
Okay, so 54 to 56.
Yeah.
What kind of stuff did you learn there? Was it working on aircraft, or was it kind of general?
It was primarily aircraft fire control systems.
Okay. What systems were you working on at the time?
Well, what we did was we redesigned the fire control system on the B-29.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
This was one of the first bombers that had remotely controlled guns. You know, where the gunner just had a sight and the guns were somewhere else on the airplane. He wasn't sitting behind a machine gun and firing out the waste gun. So it was an early advance in the fire control technology. Also, we were exposed to the computing gun sights that they used, right, were just starting to use in the fighters.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you do any flying of the B-29, or?
No, we just had mock-ups in the lab that we worked with.
Okay. And when you finished this training in 1956, where did you go?
Well, I went to Cape Canaveral.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. What were your duties there?
Well, I was a range safety officer.
Okay. And what did you do? What exactly was a range safety officer?
We worked with, of course, most of the missile launches were done by contractors.
Mm-hmm.
But we worked with them, and we came up with a safety plan for each flight, each
mm-hmm.
test,
mm-hmm.
and which were, there were predefined limits in which we were attempting to confine the flight.
Mm-hmm.
So that we didn't put any missiles into Orlando or Miami.
Right.
Everything had to stay within certain confines in
right.
a downrange direction.
Right.
And we had a radio-controlled, what they call destruct devices, and we could blow up a missile if it needed.
Mm-hmm. What kind of missiles were they?
Well, to start with, we had the Army's Redstone,
mm-hmm.
and then we had the Air Force Thor, the Air Force Atlas,
mm-hmm.
and the Air Force Titan.
Mm-hmm.
We had the Boeing Bomark, North American Snark, and a lot of other kind of experimental stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you enjoy that work?
Again.
Did you enjoy that work?
Oh, yeah. It was very interesting. We had so many firsts, you know. That
yes, sir.
It kept you on your toes and
mm-hmm.
stay up to speed of what was happening and so you could do your job without being a hazard to the flight, you know.
Mm-hmm. You were kind of there at the dawn of the missile age for the United States.
Oh, yeah. I was. In fact, and I participated in the first two manned flights.
Did you really?
Yeah.
What did you do?
I was a Marine safety officer.
Oh, okay, same thing. Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. What years were you there at Canaveral?
56 to 61.
Okay. That sounds like really interesting work. What were the first manned flights like? What do you remember about that time period?
Well, I'm sitting right here looking at a picture of Alan Shepard.
Okay.
And a picture of that missile lifting off the pad with him on top of it.
Mm-hmm. Did you meet Alan?
Yes.
Okay. Did you guys work with the astronauts?
Well, yeah, we did.
Okay.
They had a lot of other stuff to worry about, but mm-hmm. they were pretty interested in what we were doing because
mm-hmm.
We were sitting there with our thumb on the switch and we could terminate their flight any time it needed to.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things would make you hit that switch and terminate a flight? What were you looking for?
If something catastrophic happened to the missile, you know, shortly after liftoff, if it tumbled or
mm-hmm.
something like that. But then once it got flying, we had all kinds of tracking devices, radar and optical trackers, and
mm-hmm.
we could keep track of where the missile was going. And then later on, We got a little more sophisticated. We had a computerized impact predictor,
mm-hmm.
which showed us as the missile proceeded downrange if we cut off the engine exactly where it would impact.
Hmm. Okay.
So that was took a lot of the sweat out of it because it did a lot of our thinking for us.
Mm-hmm.
We just had to pretty much lay out the area that we wanted to confine the impacts to. Usually everything went pretty good. Early in the programs, there were a lot of missile failures
mm-hmm.
where the missile would lift off the pad and then fall right back down through the flame bucket. And, it took a little while for things to, you know, level out because everything was so experimental.
Right. what was the mood there when these accidents occurred?
Well, the test directors were not too happy, of course, but they never caused me any problem because we always had good cause to take any action that we did.
Mm-hmm.
We had a good record, so.
Okay. Now, were you when these launches were taking place, were you inside there with flight control, or did you have your own panel and chair there, or were you isolated somewhere else?
I was isolated from the test
okay.
director.
Okay.
We had our own plotting boards and instrumentation and communications.
Mm-hmm.
I had guys out with what we call a vertical wire sky screen, which would define the plane in space, and they could tell if the missile was programming in the downrange or direction or not.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a pretty well coordinated activity, and we had a lot of other safety things to take care of. For example, we had to keep track of all the aircraft in the vicinity of the Cape to be sure there was nobody in the launch area.
Right.
And also we had to keep track of the small boats that were all had a tendency to show up offshore.
Mm-hmm. Can you?
So we had people that patrol that area out there, and if somebody entered the area that wouldn't belong there, we'd have to take some action.
Mm-hmm. What would they do?
They'd depart.
Okay.
Nobody ever gave us any problem.
Really? Okay.
But most people were there just by accident, just curious.
Mm-hmm. Were you ever outside during one of these launches?
I shared this duty with three other officers, and each of us was assigned one or two or more missiles, and then you were the primary guy, and you manned the console and actually made all the decisions, and then the other guys manned other instrumentation or were outside observers and were feeding you information with the intercom.
Did you like being inside or outside better?
I like the inside better because you had all of the information funneled into that point. You could see everything that's going on.
Okay. Can you compare working with NASA at Cape Canaveral versus what's happened with NASA today and the advances made with the space shuttle and all of that?
It's surprisingly very much the same.
Really?
As the vehicles got more complex, the procedures got more complex.
Mm-hmm.
But the instrumentation and the control center and the displays and the way they handle the data, it all stayed pretty much the same. In fact, it's pretty much the same today, except that they launch bigger and better vehicles and have more spectacular accidents, of course.
Yes, sir. Okay, well, let me ask you about President Kennedy. When he took office, he kind of invigorated the country with his youthfulness. What was your impression of such a young president and then his statements about going to the moon and things like that?
Well, I was favorably impressed with his what he got into office.
Mm-hmm.
I was pretty much a dedicated Republican by the time he was elected, but I thought he was well suited for that job.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Were you still flying while you were at the Cape?
Yes.
Okay. What aircraft were you flying?
Well, we had C-47s, C-54s, SA-16s, UC-78s. They're all support type aircraft.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir. Okay, so 1961, where were you transferred from there?
I went to command staff school.
Oh, okay. And was that a year-long course for you?
It was a year, yeah.
Okay, and what did you learn there? What was that like for you?
It's pretty much what the name implies.
Right.
It teaches all elements of of a command and all of the staff support jobs.
Mm-hmm.
A lot of emphasis on public speaking and communications. One course that I have probably enjoyed more than the other is they teach you how to listen to a speech.
Really?
And you can classify a speech in two or three different ways. They're either something to instruct or something to inspire,
mm-hmm.
or maybe a combination. Every time I hear somebody start to make a speech, I immediately start to classify what they're doing.
Hmm, that's interesting.
Yeah.
What else do they tell you? What else do they teach you there?
Well, we did writing.
Mm-hmm.
Published papers and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a lot of lectures.
Okay.
From all kinds of outside people.
Mm-hmm. What were you, captain or major at this point?
I was a captain.
Okay. And so you finish in 1962 there at the college?
Yeah.
Okay. And where did you go from there?
I went to Headquarters Systems Command.
Mm-hmm. Where was that located?
At Andrews Air Force Base.
Okay. What happened? What did you do during the missile crisis in 1962?
During the missile crisis?
Yes, sir. What do you remember about the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962?
Well, of course, I was living on Ground Zero.
I know you. I know at Andrews. Yes, sir.
Yeah. So, and of course, we were concerned, but I don't recall any sense of panic, so
mm-hmm.
to speak. But of course, we kept close watch on what was happening as the thing progressed. It didn't last very long.
I know. Yeah. Did you have any special duties or instructions during that time period at your job?
No.
Okay. What exactly was your job there at headquarters?
Well, the first year I was there, I was assigned to the Inspector General's office.
Mm-hmm. And what did you do?
Well, we went around the command and made safety inspections.
Mm-hmm.
Of all the different organizations in the command.
Mm-hmm.
And after 2 years, they organized a division called the National Range Division,
mm-hmm.
and which was responsible for the Cape Canaveral and Vandenberg, Alamogordo. So, primarily at that level, you're primarily interested in getting funding for your subordinate groups.
Yes, sir.
And I spent a lot of time in that sort of activity. And also, I was still wearing my range safety hat.
Mm-hmm.
So I got involved in some accident investigations.
Mm-hmm.
It required quite a bit of my time.
Mm-hmm. What kind of accident investigations?
Well, we had at Vandenberg,
mm-hmm.
back in the early days of Vandenberg, we had a missile that malfunctioned shortly after liftoff, and the range safety officer blew it up, and it fell back on the base.
Mm.
And in fact, a piece of the missile penetrated the roof of a house trailer in the enlisted housing area. It didn't hurt anybody, but that of course caused a lot of concern.
Mm-hmm.
So we had a big investigation of the whole thing, and I was involved in that, and
mm-hmm.
made some recommendations for how to improve the safety of the situation.
Mm-hmm. It sounds like throughout your career at this point, you have kind of excelled at being a leader and just a lot of very important positions, especially investigating accidents and being in charge of whether or not to destruct the missiles and all that. How did you progress into that? Was leadership something that came naturally to you, or were you very comfortable with that, or was it more difficult?
Well, I don't know. I have to give my old scoutmaster some credit. I was an Eagle Scout.
Okay.
And that kind of set the tone.
Mm-hmm.
And I kind of expected to succeed.
Mm-hmm.
So, but I, as a, well, I had, for example, I had three consecutive below the zone promotions.
Okay. And that was from Captain Major to?
Captain Major to Lieutenant Colonel.
Okay. So you progressed rather rapidly then to that rank.
Yeah, about as rapid as you, a little more rapid than normal. Yeah.
Okay. Okay. After your 2 years at Andrews, where did you go?
Well, I stayed there. The National Range Division, which I mentioned, was also co-located there.
Okay.
And the commander of the National Range Division was my old boss from Patrick, and he murdered me in there instead of over in the IG.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So I got out of the IG job early and got back into the range business.
Okay. And this was, again, in 19... What year was this when you transferred over?
64.
Okay. So you stayed there, basically, at Andrews.
Yeah.
Okay. And what kind of position was that for you? What were your duties there? Was it very similar to what you'd done before?
No, it's I was called an engineering staff officer.
Okay.
And but we did. It's more clerical work than you know, actually getting out and doing stuff.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How long did you do that?
Till 1967.
Okay. And in 67, what happened? Did you?
I was sitting there minding my own business, getting ready to transfer out to Vandenberg.
Yes, sir.
And I got a set of orders to tell me to go to survival school and did the combat replacement training at Seward. And I found myself on my way to Vietnam.
Okay. What, at this point in 1967, the United States is very heavily involved in Vietnam. Did you follow what was happening in the war?
Oh, yeah.
What were your impressions of what was going on at that point?
Well, I guess that early, I really wasn't, I wasn't opinionated. I just, I resented having to go, but I accepted it as part of my job, and I did it. But as time went on, after I had been over there for a year, I kind of formed a little different opinion.
Mm-hmm. Why did you resent having to go when you were called?
Well, number one, I had two kids in high school, two young boys in high school, and I had a job waiting for me at Vandenberg that would probably have got me another promotion.
Okay. What kind of job was that?
It had been the range safety director out there.
Okay. All right. And you're at this point 42 years old, I think. Is that correct?
Yeah.
Okay. How did your family feel about you getting orders to go eventually over to Vietnam, to Southeast Asia?
My wife was very unhappy about that.
Really?
Yeah.
Why did she feel that way?
Well, because she knew I was going to be gone for a year and a half.
So you had a year and a half tour versus a 1 year tour.
Well, actually, it was 14 months.
Okay, okay. Tell me about survival school. Where was this located?
It was at up in Washington at Fairchild.
What was that like?
Well, the school up there was set up for SAC pilots. It was primarily Northwoods and Arctic survival. So that's what we did. They had a survival area, which was out in the woods, and they took us out there and we learned how to cook rabbits and build huts and survive in that respect. And then we had another phase was escape and evasion, where they you pretend that you'd just crashed your airplane someplace and you had to try to get back to your friendly area. But of course nobody made it, and they put you in prison and interrogate you, so you had some feel of what it might be like.
How did you do there at survival school?
Well, by my standard, I did very well.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure the school was too happy with me.
Why is that?
Well, the type of training was mostly role play,
mm-hmm.
and I kept trying to jazz the course up a little bit because everybody was just doing things by the numbers.
Mm-hmm.
So I was kind of fighting the faculty a little bit.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things would you do?
Say again?
What kind of things would you do to jazz it up?
Well, I'd take assume a role of a prisoner that went over to the enemy side.
Okay.
And stuff like that.
Uh huh. Okay, so how long did the survival school last?
Just a couple of months.
A couple of months?
Yeah.
Okay. Were you able to have contact with your family during this time?
I could write them a day or two.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did this include your 14 months, or was this in addition to your 14-month tour?
In addition.
Okay. And so when you finished survival school, how did you get over to Southeast Asia?
Well, first I had to go to the C-130 school.
Oh, okay. So you're going to pilot C-130s?
Yeah.
Okay. And where was this located?
At Seward Air Force Base.
Okay. What were the C-130s like for you?
Well, I really enjoyed flying the airplane because it had a lot of characteristics that I was accustomed to. It was a big, stable airplane. And
mm-hmm.
Could carry a big load, and
mm-hmm.
it was light. It was very maneuverable.
Mm-hmm.
I have to admit that I really enjoyed flying that airplane.
Did you? I've heard that often about C-130s, that it was a pretty comfortable airplane to fly.
Yeah.
Okay. How long did your training there, your pilot training for the C-130 last?
I believe it was 3 months.
Okay. Okay. And did you take to it quite easily?
Yes.
Okay. All right. And after you finished this, now you're heading off to Southeast Asia?
Right.
Okay. What year was this?
1967.
67?
Yeah.
Okay. And so how did you actually get over to Southeast Asia? Did you fly on a C-130 or?
No, I flew a commercial.
Did you really?
I was actually assigned to a squadron in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm. Okay, at CCK?
CCK, right.
Right, okay. What was that flight over like? Do you remember the mood on the plane?
Uneventful. I remember we stopped in Honolulu for fuel, and
mm-hmm.
that's about all.
Okay.
I slept a lot.
Did you? How did you feel about kind of going into a war zone? Did that bother you any?
Not really. I guess I felt a certain amount of security because I was always flying the airplane.
Right, that's true.
So, I guess you, maybe not rightly so, but you get to so you feel invincible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But I never had any serious troubles with it.
Mm-hmm.
We got shot at a lot. In fact, at night you could see it because they'd fire tracers.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But they never even came close.
Okay. Tell me what your base was like there at Taiwan. What were your living quarters like and that sort of thing?
They were fairly good. We shared a base with a Chinese fighter wing.
Mm-hmm.
And the buildings were like a little corrugated metal, but they had all the indoor plumbing, and we had a nice mess and a nice club,
mm-hmm.
a comfortable place
mm-hmm.
to work.
Okay. What were the morale? What was the morale of your comrades there, the people in your unit?
I'd say it's pretty good. The thing that was unusual about it was I reported in there as a lieutenant colonel,
mm-hmm.
and there were 19 lieutenant colonels in my squad.
Really?
Yeah.
That's an inordinate amount of lieutenant colonels.
I was the junior one.
Okay. Why did they do that?
Well, this was initially the tour, the normal tour over there was a year.
Mm-hmm.
And so the guys would go over and stay for a year and then come back to the States. Well, after about 2 years, they started running out of pilots, so they were pulling guys like me out of desk jobs and putting them back in the cockpit.
Okay.
And that's where all those guys came from. They were from all different jobs in the Air Force.
Mm-hmm.
We were all ended up in that squadron as aircraft commanders, flying combat missions in Vietnam.
Okay. How did you get along with everyone?
Okay. It was a very mature group.
Yes, sir. Exactly. How did everyone feel about, this is a mature group of lieutenant colonels. How did everyone feel about the war effort? Do you remember what was discussed?
I don't recall a lot of negativity.
Okay.
Our workload was pretty well defined, and everybody pretty much knew what they were doing, and so we didn't have a lot of problems. But it was just an inconvenience that happened to go down there. And see, when we went in country, but then we lived on a temporary base down there, it was not nearly as nice as our home base.
How long did you stay in country when you would go?
We'd go down there for about 3 weeks at a time.
Okay. And you would fly your missions from that base?
Yes.
And then come back to Taiwan for a week or so, and then go back?
Usually less than that, but
really,
I got to be the junior lieutenant colonel. I got to be the scheduling officer. So
okay,
when I was not in country, I was scheduling other flights.
Okay,
I had a full time job.
Okay, at this point, what was your understanding of what the United States was trying to accomplish in Vietnam?
Well, of course, I assume that we're trying to reinforce the South Vietnamese and get them strong enough and to defend for themselves.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, that never happened.
Right. Did you think that the Vietnamese were capable of being built up to defend themselves, or did you think they would always be dependent on someone else?
I guess by the time I left there, I was convinced that there was really a lost cause.
Okay. Okay. Well, I wonder if you could describe kind of a typical day for you while you were in Taiwan at CCK?
It was just a normal work day. I'd go down to my office at 9 o'clock or 8 o'clock in the morning and schedule all the flights for that day. Take care of my personal business. And I'd do that for maybe a week, and then I'd schedule myself to go back into Vietnam for 3 weeks.
Okay. And how often did you have to go into Vietnam? Did everybody have a quota they had to meet?
No, not really. It's just that we had so many airplanes and so many crews, and we just kept rotating first in, first out.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, yeah. Did I say that right?
First in, first out?
No, the first to come back would be the last to go big.
Right. They'd get at the bottom of the line and
and
the next person would rotate in.
Yeah, so we just rotated the crews. And,
and
of course, the same thing happened with the airplanes. We did fly the airplanes back to CCK for maintenance and, and take another aircraft that had been maintained and fly it back down there.
Now, what base did you guys fly into in Vietnam?
Primarily Thuy Hoa.
Okay. Can you describe that base and your living quarters there? And kind of how what base life was like?
Well, we lived in what they call hooches, which is a tent with a wooden floor and a wooden wall.
Okay. And how many men would live inside one of your hooches?
Oh, maybe eight.
Okay. And what kind of amenities did you have? Was it air conditioned? Did you have good cots?
No, there was no air conditioning. We just pull the flaps up on the side flaps on the tent to keep it cool.
Okay. And how did you get along with all the men there in the tent, in your hooch?
Say again?
How did you get along with the men there?
It's no problem. We were all, very busy, mm-hmm. flying every day.
Mm-hmm.
Very few personal problems or mm-hmm. conflicts. Everybody knew their job.
Did you ever form any special relationships with any of the men, any good long-lasting friendships?
I did with my crew.
Mm-hmm.
When I flew, I always flew with the same guy, the same co-pilot and navigator and loadmaster.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Flight engineer.
Okay. Can you tell me a little bit about your crew and your aircraft? Can you describe the C-130 and where everybody was positioned and what your duties were?
Well, of course, the pilot sits in the left front.
Mm-hmm. Were you always the pilot?
Yes.
Okay. Go ahead, sir.
And the lieutenant colonel's got to be, they call us aircraft commanders instead of pilots.
Mm-hmm. Yes, sir.
So, but the pilot sits in the left front seat.
Mm-hmm.
The co-pilot sits in the right front seat. And between the pilot and the co-pilot and sitting back a bit is the flight engineer.
Mm-hmm.
And he, keeps an eye on the engines and that sort of thing.
Okay.
And then behind the pilot, it was the navigator's position.
Mm-hmm.
And then the loadmaster lived in the back of the airplane. And he kept an eye on the cargo and mm-hmm. passengers. That sort of thing.
Okay. Could you describe what your typical day was like there at Tuiwa?
Well, you might go up to Naha and pick up some freight
mm-hmm.
and take it up to Da Nang, or you might go to Da Nang and take some freight to Kang Tri or someplace up there.
Mm-hmm.
And when the TEP war started,
mm-hmm.
we threw a lot of stuff into Khe Sanh.
Did you really? What was that experience like, the Tet Offensive at Khe Sanh?
Well, it was a bit hair-raising
mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
because there was a lot of ground fire up there.
Right.
And I landed a few times up there, but pretty early during the offensive, they stopped letting us go in there in the C-130s.
Why did they do that?
Well, because the runway was getting beat up.
Mm-hmm.
And they didn't want to take a chance on losing the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
Also, there was a lot of ground incoming in there, and we frequently didn't get hits on the loading ramp
mm-hmm.
or out on the ends of the runway.
Would you usually, you said you flew in a few times and landed, would you land, offload, and take off as quickly as possible?
Yeah.
Okay.
We did what they call a speed offload. You just stop, drop the ramp, and then accelerate the airplane and drive right out from under the load.
Hmm, okay.
You just lay it right out on the ramp.
Did you do any airdrops?
Yeah, I did several.
Mm-hmm.
We had a drop zone, which was up off the west end of the runway.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how many, maybe a half dozen or so
mm-hmm.
airdrops I flew up there. Probably the most interesting of those was when the weather was bad, we'd fly. The Marine Corps had a GCA unit,
mm-hmm.
and we'd fly a GCA approach. And the GCA operator put us over the end of the runway,
mm-hmm.
and then the navigator would navigate from there to the center of the drop zone.
Okay.
And we got pretty good at keeping stuff confined to the drop zone.
Mm-hmm. What kind of things would you carry into Khe Sanh?
Say again?
What kind of things did you carry into Khe Sanh?
Oh, mostly like food and clothing and ammunition.
Mm-hmm. Were there any particular instances you remember about those flights into Khe Sanh? Anything happened that stands out in your memory today?
Well, Yeah, what, the last time that I landed there was a pretty tense operation because there was a lot of ground fire, and so we landed and took off almost immediately.
Mm-hmm.
And I got another air medal for doing that.
Did you really?
Yeah.
Okay. What kind of things would you carry around Vietnam? What was your cargo like?
It could be anything. We kind of like artillery pieces, jeeps,
mm-hmm.
all kinds of clothing and food, ammo,
mm-hmm.
passengers, water passengers.
Were these American troops or Vietnamese troops or both?
Well, most of it just happened that most of our troops were Marines, and we supported the things up in the north end of the country, which was a Marine territory.
Mm-hmm, right.
So we flew a lot of Marines in there.
Okay. Were there any particular bases that you flew into that are very distinct or something that stands out about those bases going into Quang Tri or... Or
no, not really. They were all pretty much the same.
Really?
Yeah, they were pretty primitive, though. Some of them had very few facilities.
Mm-hmm. Were there any that were particularly dangerous to you besides Khe San?
No, not particularly. Like I said, at night... you could see the tracers coming up, which you didn't see in the daytime, so you didn't even know they were there.
Right.
But it was a bit disconcerting to have that stuff coming up at you, but nobody ever came close to my airplane, so I always felt fairly secure.
Mm-hmm. Now, your airplane was never hit by fire?
No.
Okay. How did you... go ahead.
About the only hits that anybody in our group took is once while when they were coming on the final approach down low, that some VC guy get a bullet into the wheel well.
Mm-hmm.
Which was, minor damage, but
mm-hmm.
still disturbing.
Now, how did it feel to be shot at? What were your feelings?
Well, it's... I guess once you realize they missed you, there's a kind of a feeling of exhilaration that,
mm-hmm.
that you survived.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever witness anyone being wounded there, on the airplanes or elsewhere?
I hauled a lot of wounded people out of there.
And what kind of contact would you have with these wounded? You were the aircraft commander, so did you ever talk to any of these soldiers?
No, not really. When we had litter patients, we usually had medics that were and we'd get them loaded and
mm-hmm.
and try to get them over to Da Nang to the hospital as mm-hmm. fast as possible.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Did you ever carry dead bodies?
Yes.
How did you feel about that?
Bad.
Really?
Yeah, that's kind of tough. It kind of demoralized the crew. You get this back into the airplane full of these guys in those bags.
Mm-hmm. What would they say about it?
Well, I had a loadmaster when I broke down and cried.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What are your general impressions of the enemy, of the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong?
Say again?
What are your general impressions of the enemy, the North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong forces?
The Vietnamese?
Yes, sir. The North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong forces. What were your impressions of those?
Well, they were just highly motivated and
mm-hmm.
and cleverly trained. They survived and situations that our guys were having a lot of trouble with.
Mm-hmm.
But there was an old joke about the Ho Chi Minh Trail, and they'd give a guy two mortar rounds, send him 100 miles down that trail, and mm-hmm. he'd hand it to the gunner, and the gunner would launch his two missiles and say, okay, go back and get two more. I'm just saying that kind of was a pretty primitive operation, but they seemed to be highly motivated and
mm-hmm.
tenacious.
Mm-hmm. Were they kind of like you expected, or were they different in a way?
There was so little difference between the North and the South Vietnamese
mm-hmm.
From my viewpoint. Mm-hmm. I guess I didn't really have a preconceived idea of what they should be like.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about what you thought of the Vietnamese themselves, the Vietnamese civilians. What kind of contact did you have with them?
Almost none.
Really?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you form any impressions about them?
Not any strong impressions. I don't recall anything
mm-hmm.
that's really worth making an issue out of.
Okay. What did you think of...
people trying to survive.
Uh-huh. What did you think of Vietnam itself, the country?
By the time I left there, I saw it as a lost cause.
Did you really? Okay. What kind of weapons did you guys carry on your airplanes? Were you armed at all?
Yeah, we had M15 rifles.
Okay. Did you have a sidearm?
No.
Okay. Did you wear body armor of any kind?
Not when we were flying, no.
Okay. Okay. Did you ever work with any troops from the South Vietnamese Army or, say, the Australians or New Zealanders or South Koreans?
No.
No exposure to them at all?
No.
Okay. Did you hear rumors about the South Vietnamese Army and their capabilities?
No, none that I recall.
Okay. Well, let's talk a little bit about base life at Thuy Hoa and then back at CCK. How much contact did you have with home, with your wife and your family?
We communicated with tapes
mm-hmm.
primarily,
mm-hmm.
and I'd usually get one a week, maybe.
Okay. You would get one a week, and would you send one a week?
Yes.
Okay. Did you ever get to make any of those Mars phone calls?
On a couple of occasions, but it was not very satisfactory.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. How about R&Rs? Were you able to take one?
Yeah.
Where did you?
Yes, I got a trip back home for, I guess, 2 weeks.
Back to the United States?
Yeah.
Wow. What was that like for you?
Well, I was delighted.
Mm-hmm.
Get out of Vietnam and Taiwan and
mm-hmm.
get home with my wife and family for a short time.
Right, right. Back in Vietnam, did you ever get to attend any of the USO shows?
Yeah. We had a Bob Hope troop
mm-hmm.
One time. And my squadron got the job of flying them around in-country, places where they were performing, and
mm-hmm.
I got to see one of their performances.
Really? Did you get to meet Bob Hope?
Did I what?
Did you meet Bob Hope yourself?
No.
Okay. All right. What would you all do for entertainment there on base?
Go to the movies.
Really? What kind of movies would you see?
Oh, I don't know.
Everything?
Whatever they were showing,
uh-huh.
we watched.
Uh-huh. What about the officers' clubs and things like that?
Yeah, we had officers' clubs. And that was primarily our they were officers' messes
mm-hmm.
and where we ate.
Was this at Thuy Hoa and at CCK?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you see any excessive use of alcohol while you were there?
No.
Okay. Would you guys drink for kind of relaxation? Or was there a particular group that that would do that and others that would not?
I don't recall anybody having a particular problem. We, you know, you might have a drink before dinner or something like that.
Mm-hmm. Okay. How about drug use? Did you witness any of that?
Say again?
Did you witness any drug use?
I didn't see any. I heard of some.
Really? What did you hear?
I just heard that one of the loadmasters in another squadron was caught bringing drugs back into CCK from mid-country.
Okay. Okay.
He was disciplined. I don't remember exactly what happened.
Mm-hmm. Were you able to keep up with news from the United States at all?
Keep up with what?
News. What was happening back in the States?
Oh, yeah. We had good radios in the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
And we could listen to the Armed Forces Network and all that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm. Did you have television access at all?
No.
Even in Taiwan, you had no televisions?
No.
Okay. Looking at some of your entertainment things, did you guys listen to music at all?
Yeah.
What songs come to mind that remind you of your time in Vietnam?
I can't wait to get out of this place.
Okay. I can see why that would be popular.
That was our theme song.
Yeah. Oh, yeah? Okay. Were you ever exposed to any wild animals or anything like that? I've heard about the rats in Vietnam are pretty bad. Did you Did you see any of those?
I don't recall ever having any. Uh-huh. With
that. Okay. Did you experience or witness any race issues while you were there in Vietnam?
No.
Okay. So that was not a problem that you saw.
Not as I saw it.
Okay. Okay. What would you say was the bravest thing that you witnessed in Vietnam?
The bravest
incident.
Well, the one I was most involved in.
Mm-hmm.
I was the airlift commander at Khe Sanh for
mm-hmm.
14 days. And when I went up there, I took with me a combat control team that had a new load extraction system, which was a cable that we stretched across the runway with water breaks on each end.
Mm-hmm.
And we had to install that with you know, big steel spikes that anchor those wheels
mm-hmm.
besides the runway. And while we were up doing that, we started getting sniper fire from off the base.
Mm-hmm.
And that got to be pretty bad, and so we finally ceased trying to stall the thing in the daytime, and we went out at night.
Mm-hmm. And did you receive sniper fire at night?
Yeah. No, we didn't receive any fire at night.
Okay.
They couldn't see.
Right. Now, and you were actually on the ground at Khe Sanh for 14 days?
Yes.
I was
the airlift commander for 14 days.
Okay. Can you describe what that was like? What was the mood on the base?
Well, that was a Marine. The base is occupied by the Marines.
Mm-hmm.
And those guys are, you know, high energy, highly motivated. I guess it kind of rubbed off on my guys. And
mm-hmm.
I had a combat control team, and I had an aeroport team
mm-hmm.
to offload the airplane.
Mm-hmm.
The combat control team controlled the air drops.
Mm-hmm.
I had one of my guys. We had a foxhole out in the middle of the drop zone, and one of the combat controllers manned that foxhole during the drops, and he could set off a smoke bomb to mark the center of the drop area.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, the guy who was out there. An incoming ground landed not pretty close to his foxhole, and he stood up, and another round came in, and he got some shrapnel through his arm.
He said he wasn't killed, just wounded?
No, just wounded.
Okay.
We took him back to the dispenser, and he got his Purple Heart right on the spot.
Really?
Yeah.
This was one of your men?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And another one was I had another one that was hit by a shrapnel, and it hit him in the elbow. And he got on top of it. And I had another one that one of my aerial pork guys was standing outside my bunker drinking juice out of a tin can.
This is a caisson?
Yes.
Okay.
And a sniper bullet went right through that can and knocked it out of his mouth.
Out of his mouth?
Yeah.
Wow.
He was drinking out of it and it hit my sniper. But he didn't do it. He wasn't injured. But he was surprised. He thought somebody knocked it out, you know. But when he saw that hole in the can, he didn't get it.
Did you try to stay indoors most of the time?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
We were pretty well protected. We had, on the flight line, we had the controllers have a radios in their Jeep. And they had revetted the Jeep, so just the antenna sticking up.
Okay.
And I had a, what they call a Conac box. It's a corrugated steel cargo container. It's about 6 feet by 6 feet by 6 feet. That was revetted and sandbagged. And that's where I had communications in there. And that's where I operated during the day.
Okay.
We had a bunker. There were three reinforced concrete bunkers up there that were built by the Air Force. And they were using it as the airborne four air controllers. And when the Marines came in, the Air Force kept one of them, the Marine Command Control Center, too. And the third one is the medics, too. So we had an underground, for all those Air Force people that had it, we had an underground bunker that was very secure, and we were far enough from the perimeter. We had all those Marines between us and the perimeter, so we were pretty well guarded. I never had to worry about, you know, somebody infiltrating.
Right. Would you say that that time at Quezon was your most dangerous time in country?
Oh, yeah.
Okay.
We had, you know, like 1,500 rounds in one day.
Wow. Well, how would you rate the leadership that you had personally in Vietnam?
Well, I guess I have to say it was mediocre.
Okay.
See, you had a very mature group of people. We had 19 lieutenant colonels.
Yes, sir.
And they don't require a lot of supervision. But the most senior of those lieutenant colonels was the squadron commander. And I hardly ever saw him. But we all, you know, had our jobs and do what we were doing. It wasn't really a big problem.
So because he was out of sight all the time, that was that was not so good?
He was never in country with us.
Oh, really?
He was over at CCK.
Why did he not go in country?
Oh, I don't know. I suppose he did go down sometime, but it seemed to me like he was always in his office.
Okay.
CCK.
What did you think of the overall military leadership in Vietnam?
I thought it was good. We shared bases with the fighter guys and the Marines. And, I thought, you know, there was really not a lot of conflicts. Just everybody had his job to do and did it.
Okay. Now, did you know the exact date that you were going to leave CCK and go back to the States?
I got extended twice.
Did you really? Was that by choice, or did they do that to you?
No, it was not by choice.
Okay.
It was supposed to be a one-year tour.
Right.
And I think I was one day short of 14 weeks.
Why did they extend you?
14 months,
right? 14 months, right. Why did they extend you?
Well, they ran out of replacements. See, they were getting... When they pulled guys like me back into the cockpit, Mm-hmm. They were getting pretty close to the bottom of the barrel.
Mm-hmm.
So rather than send people back that had already been there a year, they'd stretch it out a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Now, did you complain about this, or did you kind of just go along with the show?
Well, I was not at all happy about it, but mm-hmm. I didn't complain too loudly.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Of course, everybody else had to do the same thing.
Oh, really? Okay. You wrote on your questionnaire that you flew a total of 458 missions in South Vietnam.
Yeah.
Was that 458 different flights, or would you have multiple missions during one day?
I have multiple missions in one day. They refer to them as sorties.
Okay, okay.
So one flight from point A to point B.
Mm-hmm.
And you had to be in a designated combat zone for it to count as a sortie.
You had to be in what? Inside the combat zone?
Yeah.
Okay, okay. And did you fly missions elsewhere besides South Vietnam?
Yes.
Where did you go?
Thailand.
Okay.
We had a little airline at Bangkok that we flew.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we had over three or four fighter bases over there.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd fly two flights a day around those bases. One plane would go clockwise, the other would go counterclockwise.
Mm-hmm.
And we had a requisitioned hotel in Bangkok. It was pretty neat duty.
Mm-hmm.
And I think I did that twice.
What kind of things did you fly over?
Just mostly passengers.
Okay.
Like the mail and fresh food and stuff.
Mm-hmm. Did you ever get to go out and experience Thailand itself, the country, or were you regulated to the hotel?
Well, no, we could move around like in the city of Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
We were all over the place. They had a lot of interesting restaurants. And,
mm-hmm.
There were several clubs. And there's a lot of sightseeing things to see.
Mm-hmm. Did you take advantage of those things?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What would you say were the differences between the Vietnamese and the Thai people?
I think the Thai people were just maybe better educated and a little more sophisticated than
mm-hmm.
the Vietnamese.
Okay. What gave you that impression? Did they interact better with Americans, or was it just their culture?
Just the culture. The difference, like the difference between Saigon and Bangkok.
Mm-hmm.
It was a marked difference between the quality of the, you know, the city.
Mm-hmm. What was your impression of Saigon, the city?
Very favorable.
Really? Why so?
Oh, I'm not Saigon. I'm thinking
of Bangkok.
Bangkok.
Okay, okay. Well, tell me about Bangkok. What was that like?
Well, it was, you know, you'd hardly know the war was going on there.
Really?
Because there was no hazardous areas anywhere in the country.
Mm-hmm.
But Saigon was. It was kind of a ratty place, and I didn't spend much time there. In fact, I don't think I ever even spent the night there.
Really?
We'd fly over there, pick up a load, fly out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Let's talk about when you left Taiwan and went back to the United States. Did you fly a commercial flight back?
Yes.
Okay. What was that flight like? What was it like? Was it different than the flight over?
No, it's very much the same.
Really? Subdued?
Yeah.
Okay. Did you bring any souvenirs or anything home with you?
Yes.
What did you bring home?
Well, I bought some furniture that I bought in Taiwan.
Mm-hmm.
I bought a bunch of electronic stuff that I bought in the Navy Exchange.
Mm-hmm.
and I bought a couple of weapons that I bought in the Navy Exchange.
What kind of weapons?
A 38 caliber pistol and a 22 caliber pistol.
Okay. Anything else?
Well, a bunch of odds and ends that I thought my wife might like to have.
Right, right. Okay. What kind of reception did you get back in the United States when you came back? Did you ever have any problems at the airports?
No. I flew into Travis.
Mm-hmm.
And then I flew commercial to Los Angeles. But I knew I was going to be assigned to Edwards Air Force Base when I got back.
Okay.
And my wife and the children moved there before I came back.
Okay. So they were there to greet you.
Sort of. They were waiting for me in Disneyland.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So I flew into L.A. and just took a cab to Disneyland and met them down there.
Uh-huh. How was that experience?
Oh, it was wonderful.
Yeah. Did you have any trouble transitioning back to stateside life versus being over in Asia?
No, I don't think so.
Really? Okay. Did you discuss your Vietnam experience with other people? Did they ask you about it?
Oh, I suppose so. You know, there were so many people around. Most of my friends had done essentially the same thing I had.
Mm-hmm.
Gotten recalled and put back in the cockpit.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody had a few stories to tell.
How about civilians? Did civilians ask you about what you did?
I don't recall, other than my relatives.
Mm-hmm. You came back in 1969, is that correct?
68,
okay. What was your impression of the anti-war movement that was going on?
Well,
I was
not favorably impressed. I thought it was an abomination for these people to be able to do that.
Really? What bothered you most about it?
Well, I just thought occasionally about all those dead guys I hauled out of there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, kind of a reception that people were getting coming back to the state.
Mm-hmm. What did you think of the continuing war effort when you left? Did you keep up with what was happening over there?
Yeah. Pretty much, I guess.
What was your opinion of it?
Well, by the time I got back, I thought that we'd already lost the war.
Really? Why did you think that?
I just didn't see any way for us to win. The idea was we were going to train up those South Vietnamese so that they could fend for themselves,
mm-hmm.
and I just didn't see that happen.
Really? Why not?
It just seemed to me that they never were that independent. They were always, you know, attached to a bunch of our guys.
Mm-hmm. What did you think about the United States withdrawal in 1973? Do you remember how you felt?
Say again?
In 1973, when the United States withdrew from South Vietnam, how did you feel?
Well, I guess I was relieved to see them get out of there.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't see any, you know, I saw it as a losing situation.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And I thought we should have gotten that.
How did you feel in April 1975 when South Vietnam fell as a country?
Yeah. Well, I was, say, saddened but not surprised.
Really?
They just the South Vietnamese just weren't as motivated as the North Vietnamese guys.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. What did you think of the media coverage of the war? Do you think it was portrayed accurately or thoroughly?
Yeah, I thought they did a pretty good job.
Mm-hmm. Why did you think they did a good job?
Because they allowed the reporter to go right out there with the truth.
Mm-hmm.
And the news reports that I got from those guys that were the news people that were over there, I thought was a pretty accurate portrayal of what was going on.
Right. Okay. Looking back at your service today, how do you feel about your service in Vietnam?
Well, I have mixed emotions. I was unhappy about being there, and I saw it as kind of an outstanding cause, but I enjoyed the hell out of flying.
Okay, so can you say that again? I didn't understand you.
I just enjoyed the flying.
You enjoyed the flying, but you did not like being there.
No.
Okay. So it was good to get back in the cockpit and fly so much?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
That's all I had to do, it was a fairly simple life, but it gave me an opportunity to become very proficient in that airplane.
Mm-hmm.
I had a lot of personal satisfaction out of that.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything that you would change about your experience in Vietnam if you could?
No, not really. I think I kind of had the best of what was there.
Mm-hmm.
The Thuy Hoa was a fairly secure base, and
mm-hmm.
the facilities were a little primitive, but we had good food and good
mm-hmm.
children.
Right. What do you think was the most significant thing that you learned while you were in Vietnam?
The most what?
The most significant thing that you learned while you were over there in Vietnam and in Taiwan?
Oh, I suppose one of the things I learned was that to not fight the system, but to get in there and do your job as best you can and
mm-hmm.
and try to protect your crew and survive.
Mm-hmm.
There was no reason to fight the system.
Okay. How do you think the war has most affected your life?
Well, the main thing it did is it disrupted my career.
Really? How so?
Well, before I got into Vietnam thing, I had a job at Vandenberg.
Mm-hmm.
Would almost assured me another promotion.
Mm-hmm.
Now, after being out of the loop for 2 years, those jobs were all filled while I was gone.
Mm-hmm.
So I got an assignment up to Edwards Air Force Base, which I felt poorly qualified for, and an assignment that I would not have desired under any circumstances.
What was your job there at Andrews?
I was a safety director.
Okay.
So I knew from past experience that no safety director in the systems command had ever been promoted to colonel.
Mm-hmm.
So I applied for retirement.
You applied for retirement?
Yeah.
Okay.
You had to wait a year after you applied before you could retire. So
mm-hmm.
after I'd been there 30 days, I put in my letter.
Okay. Looking at... Well, you had this combat experience. Did you think that did not help you at all in trying to get a promotion?
No.
Okay.
I was just, like I say, one of 19 lieutenant colonels.
Right, right.
So.
What kind of lessons do you think the United States learned in Vietnam from the war, if any?
Well, I hope we learn not to put ourselves in an unwinnable situation,
mm-hmm.
Which I think we so far we've been fairly successful in doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But that was just a no-win situation almost from the start. I thought Lyndon Johnson was completely incompetent,
mm-hmm.
and I still was unhappy about that. Spending all that money and all those lives away from nothing.
Mm-hmm. I guess compared to, I mean, you had witnessed a lot of commander-in-chiefs from Franklin Roosevelt all the way to, I guess, to Lyndon Johnson and Richard Nixon when you got out. And I was going to ask you to compare Johnson to those other commander-in-chiefs, and I think you just did.
I just did.
Yes, sir.
Incompetent is the word.
Mm-hmm. Did you think the politicians simply didn't understand what was happening over there, or they didn't try to understand what was happening there?
Well, I think maybe it was a two-headed problem. I don't think they understood, and I don't think they were getting factual information from their field commanders.
Really?
You know, Westmoreland kept telling them, they'll send me another 500,000 troops to win this thing. You know? I felt that it's just a bad situation, commander-wise.
What do you think the United States could have done differently to win that war?
I'm not sure we could ever have won that war the way it transpired.
Mm-hmm.
I think where we missed the boat is back in the early days when the French, where we went in and helped the French fight the North Vietnamese.
Mm-hmm.
And when the French lost and left, we could have adopted Ho Chi Minh.
Right.
But we didn't. We went with the Catholic from the South.
Mm-hmm.
So I think that just set the situation as an illusion.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
So, in my opinion, it was a religious war.
A religious war?
Yes.
Between what religions?
Yeah, the South Vietnamese were Catholic.
Mm-hmm.
North Vietnamese were Buddhist.
Okay. What do you think about Vietnam today? Do you think off to another country?
Oh, I think it's made a lot of progress. And, by this time, I think it's probably much better off than when we pulled out of it.
Mm-hmm.
We went through a lot of pain and punishing people and adapting.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But,
would you ever want to go back to visit?
No.
Why not?
Well, I just can't think of any place down there that I want to see again.
Right. Have you had any contact with Vietnamese here in the United States?
No.
I'm sorry?
No.
Okay. Have you read any good books on the Vietnam War that you would recommend?
Yes, I have two right here in front.
Really? What are they?
This is a book called Air Power and the Fight for Quezon.
Okay.
It's from the Office of Air Force History.
Uh-huh.
And it's available from the Government Printing Office.
Mm-hmm. Why is that a good book, do you think?
It just gives a complete, detailed analysis and history of what transpired at Quezon, how we got in there, and what happened over there, and how we got out.
Mm-hmm. Okay. What's the other book?
The other book is titled Tactical Airlift.
Tactical Airlift?
Yes.
Okay. And is that a history of tactical airlift, or is it?
It's the United States Air Force in Southeast Asia.
Oh, okay.
Tactical Airlift. It's written by a fellow named Ray Bowers, who was in my squad.
Really?
Yes.
Okay. Are you in that book?
Yep. Yes.
Okay. So he does a pretty accurate rendition of what happened.
Yeah. He was a professional historian. And, it's a very well-written book. And it's not just about the Quezon. It's about the whole tactical airlift mission.
Right. Okay. How about movies about Vietnam? Do you ever go see the movies, or have you seen movies about the war?
I've got some documentaries that, that you see on TV. It's pretty much a a record of what transpired.
Mm-hmm. But you don't go see the Hollywood movies?
No.
Is there a reason why you don't?
Well, I guess I haven't been there. I don't think there's much for me to learn.
Okay. All right. Have you ever been to the Wall in Washington, D.C.?
No, I have not.
Have you ever seen one of the traveling walls?
No.
Do you have a desire to see that?
Well, maybe. I know a couple of people that are.
Mm-hmm. So you might travel to Washington sometime to see that, or is it something that you're not really that concerned with?
I don't think I would make a special trip to that, but if I were in Washington, I'd be back to over there.
Mm-hmm. Okay. If you had to talk to a group of young students today, what would you tell them about the Vietnam War?
I don't know. I guess I would tell them that they should maybe involve themselves more in the political process.
Mm-hmm.
Do what they could to ensure we had elected good leaders.
Mm-hmm.
That the country was doing what it should.
Mm-hmm. What do you think about the situation today with the pending war with Iraq? Do you think there are any similarities with the Vietnam War?
No, not in my opinion.
Okay.
I'm sure there are people that would try to draw a parallel.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay. Well, sir, is there anything else that you'd like to talk about today or add to our conversation?
I don't know. I think I've told you about everything I know.
Okay. Well, we certainly appreciate your time, and we'll go ahead and end the interview now with Don Davis. Thank you very much, sir.
Okay.